Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 11th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, identifying proteins involved in HIV infection, using the immune system to treat cancer, glaciers during global warming 91 million years ago, and thinking about a new science career, second chances at first loves. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
How does a virus take over a cell's own machinery to make copies of itself? In the case of HIV, figuring out that answer could save many people's lives. Now, a new tool using functional genomic screening has helped researchers identify what factors HIV uses in the cell. In a paper published online by Science, Stephen Elledge and colleagues describe how that functional genomic screen works. I spoke with Elledge from his office at Harvard University about how this new knowledge could be used to keep HIV and other viruses from replicating themselves in your body.
So HIV is a virus that attacks the immune system, and it's actually a very sort of compact, minimal virus. It has just 9 genes, and these genes encode only about 15 proteins. But they have to do a lot of things. They have to find the immune cells. They have to bind and go into the immune cells, and they have to find their way into the nucleus, and they integrate into the DNA and make copies of themselves. And then they assemble a virus, and then they have to be released from the cell so they can infect other cells. That's what we call the HIV life cycle. And with only 9 genes to carry out all those functions, the HIV virus has to rely on lots of cellular proteins. In fact, HIV, you could say, hijacks the cellular machinery to do what it needs to do. And so that is a great strategy, and all viruses take a strategy like that because they have very few genes, but they have to duplicate themselves. And so they use the cell's machinery. But it also presents vulnerabilities for the virus.
What in particular?
It relies now on lots of host functions that if you can interfere with those, they may be able to interfere with the virus's life cycle.
How are therapies working so far?
The therapies for HIV have focused on making drugs to inhibit some of the 15 proteins that it makes, like the protease or the polymerases. And it's a great strategy, and it works to a certain degree. But the problem is that HIV is a highly mutable virus. And so it changes its genome around and also changes the proteins it encodes. So it can change the target of the drug so that it no longer binds the drug that well. So you can evolve resistance to the virus, even if you're taking the right drug, so the drugs become useless after a while. Now, the way that scientists have tried to get around that is that they've used multiple drugs simultaneously to target different proteins in the virus, and then that decreases the likelihood that you'll get mutations to all 3 at any one time, so it's harder to develop resistance. Although there are some resistant viruses out there already. Also, these medicines have various side effects for people. So while it is, they're doing a really good job of keeping people alive, they're not perfect, but they do work to some degree.
And what your group is doing differs from that in that you're going to be targeting these actual proteins and the mechanisms of the cell itself in order to shut it down?
That's exactly right. So what we're trying to do is to get an understanding of, first of all, what's the HIV life cycle like? What cellular proteins does it depend upon to duplicate itself and live in your body? And those then become a collection of genes that do 2 things. One is, of course, it allows you to generate hypotheses about how the virus works, and you can understand its life cycle a lot better. And there are a lot of surprises in this collection of host proteins that are needed for HIV.
Did you say surprises?
Yes, surprises, things that you wouldn't have anticipated, people don't understand and will need to figure out. Okay, so there are lots of new genes here that people couldn't have guessed. And that's why doing genetic screens like we did in an unbiased way gives you a lot of information because you don't have to know the answer. The answers come out. And so the set of proteins will provide a lot of insight to how the virus actually functions, and people may be able to use that information to somehow circumvent the virus. But the other way you can look at it is that now this group of 273 proteins is 15 times the size of the number of proteins encoded by HIV. And now they're more targets. They're potential targets.
And those are the ones that the virus makes use of within the cell, is
right,
that right?
It needs those to live, yeah, and replicate efficiently. And so presumably some of these will end up being drug targets for drug companies to find. And of course, now that if you're attacking host proteins, two things come into play, one good and one potentially bad. The good thing is that if you get something you can inhibit, then the virus will probably not be able to mutate to get around that. Because it's not the same as changing one amino acid to change a binding site on an HIV protein. Now the HIV would have to evolve a new function altogether. And that's not going to happen very efficiently. So if you use drugs to the host cell, that potentially is much better. Okay, so that's the upside. And the downside, the potential downside, is that if the organism, us, needs that particular protein, if you inhibit it, we might get sick, so it may make people have other problems. And, of course, that's true for any drug. If anyone finds a drug target and they decide that they're going to make a drug that inhibits it, it has to be tested in people to see how people tolerate having that pathway reduced.
Okay. Well, let's get then a little bit into how this screening mechanism worked in which you identify these 273 proteins that the virus uses for its own replication within the cell. How did you go about doing that?
Well, we took advantage of a new and very important development in mammalian genetics called RNA interference. The Nobel Prize was given for that, I think, a year ago to Andy Fire and Craig Mello, who found the roots of it, and other people developed it as a method. And what this method allows you to do is to introduce an RNA sequence into cells. And this RNA sequence is designed to recognize the messenger RNA for a particular gene. So, as you know, genes make RNA, which is sort of like a recipe that's read off by a ribosome to make a protein. And what RNA interference does is that it can specifically find one particular messenger RNA encoded by a gene and destroy it. So it never gets to make the protein. Okay? And
okay.
That's similar to deleting the gene out of the genome. And that if you deleted that piece of DNA that encoded the protein, you couldn't make the protein and you'd have a cell missing that one protein.
That's gene silencing, or is that
something else? It's post-transcriptional gene silencing. But
okay.
Yeah. It's a way to functionally turn off a gene. So you're still making the RNA, but you're destroying it as fast as you're making it. So you don't make enough of the protein. And so we can do this one gene at a time. And we can take the cells that we've inactivated a particular gene and infect them with HIV and say, well, can you still make HIV now? And if the answer is no, then we say, hey, this gene product, this protein that's no longer made is probably important for the virus to function. And we did this for over 20,000 human proteins, all the known, currently known proteins, to figure out which ones might be important.
So this was an exhaustive approach?
Yes. Yeah, it was very thorough. We wanted to cover everything. We wanted to leave no stone unturned to see what the list looked like. And that's how we did it. And this can be applied to other viruses as well. It's a method that people all over the world are now beginning to use to study all kinds of problems. We use it also to study cancer, to find new cancer genes and new ways to kill cancer cells. So there's a lot to be done using these methods, and there's a lot of gene discovery that will be made. But hopefully we're going to find key drug targets this way, in an unbiased way.
So really, this paper is describing this power of the RNA interference to find out the dependencies of human pathogens, such as HIV, but not exclusively HIV. You could use this in all kinds of different disease identifications.
That's right. And you could study cells to see, you know, well, how can we change their ability to use glucose or something for diabetes? Or how can we increase the ability of cells to express insulin or decrease it or anything like that? As long as you can develop an assay that you can read out easily, you can do the screen and find out the genes. It's an incredibly powerful technology and something that my lab has been working on for the last 5 years in various forms. And so it's great days to be a geneticist. That's what I think.
Stephen Elledge, thank you very much.
Okay, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Stephen Elledge is senior author of a paper on hundreds of possible new HIV-1 host factors and the functional genomic screen used to find them. You can read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Also this week in science, counting systems can become simpler over time. The general assumption about counting systems is that they become more complex as cultures evolve, from pre-mathematical conception of numbers to those of greater and greater abstraction. In contrast to that general assumption, Sieghart Beller and Andrea Bender report in a paper that in some cultures, counting systems have evolved to become simpler. These so-called object-specific sequences, as ways of counting, can be shown to be cognitively advantageous for calculations and extend the limits of counting. Read their paper, The Limits of Counting: Numerical Cognition Between Evolution and Culture, in this week's Science. Cancer is the uncontrolled division of abnormal cells in the body, and for decades, researchers have been trying to prevent or treat cancer using the body's own immune system, the so-called cancer vaccine, and other immunotherapies. But those attempts to recruit the immune system to fight cancerous cells have largely ended in failure, at least in human patients. Now, researchers may have an explanation for that failure and some potential new routes to treatment. In this week's Science, senior correspondent Jean Marks reports on what researchers are learning about myeloid-derived suppressor cells, which block the immune system from killing cancerous cells.
Well, researchers or cancer researchers have been trying to find ways to harness the immune system to fight cancer for actually decades at this point. And although they've had some very, very modest successes, for the most part, those efforts haven't worked very well in the clinic. They work with animal models, but you can almost always cure cancer in a mouse. It gets a lot harder in a human. And so they've been trying to find out why. And within the past few years, it appears that this new, well, not new cells, but cells that have been known for some time but have recently been linked to cancer, appear to be playing a big role in damping down the responses that ought to be useful in fighting a growing cancer.
So what are these cells and what are they doing? What's happening?
Well, these cells are called myeloid-derived suppressor cells. And there have been sightings of the cells for 30 or more years, but it was only within the past maybe 5 years or so that researchers began to find that they were at least partially responsible for blocking tumor-fighting immune responses. One of the things that in most clinical trials, they test new therapies on people with very advanced cancers. And one of the things they found that the more cancer grows, the more of these cells are around. So when they try to use, an anti-cancer vaccine to target a person's cancer, these cells, just there are a lot of them around and they can block those protective immune responses.
What is the normal purpose of these cells?
Researchers think that they are probably normally involved in turning down the immune response once it's done its job. So, if you need to fight an infection like the cold that I have right now, you need your immune system to do that. But once the cold goes away, you want the immune system to go back down to its normal activity level. And so these cells are probably involved in that. But somehow in a cancer patient, due to a lot of things that the cancers are actually putting out to encourage the production of these cells, they hang around in this active state when they shouldn't be there.
So how is it that these cells block immune responses?
They turn out to be very versatile in the types of immune responses that they block. The myeloid-derived suppressor cells can block several kinds of immune cells. One of these in particular, researchers are trying to beef up the so-called T cells of the immune system to get them to recognize and attack antigens on tumor cells and destroy those tumor cells. But it turns out that the myeloid-derived suppressor cells can block those activated T cells from doing their job. So that's one way. Another way is there's evidence that they block so-called natural killer cells, which are a different kind of immune cell. They can work on so-called macrophages, which have a variety of functions in promoting immune responses. But macrophages come in two types, so-called type 1, which can attack tumor cells, and so-called type 2, which are pro-inflammatory and tend to promote tumor growth. So the myeloid-derived suppressor cells apparently can convert type 1 to type 2 in macrophages, and therefore that's another way. And then myeloid-derived suppressor cells are in the pathway for making dendritic cells, which start immune responses. But as the myeloid-derived suppressor cells go up, the dendritic cells go down, so there are fewer of those. I mean, as I said, there are many ways that these things can interfere with immune responses.
So how are researchers looking to use this information in order to prevent or treat cancer?
They're exploring several approaches. One is because the myeloid-derived suppressor cells are immature, they're trying to promote them to differentiate and become mature. There's a drug called ATRA, A-T-R-A, all-trans-retinoic acid, which is already used to treat a particular leukemia. But it has the function of promoting differentiation of these cells. And in one, I think it was one test of patients with kidney cancer, it was very short term. It wasn't intended to show tumor shrinkage. But it did show it that this drug beefed up these patients' immune responses in the right direction. So now they want to do another clinical trial, a more advanced clinical trial. But one thing that the researcher doing that work is Dmitry Gabrilovich in Florida has pointed out very strongly is that the whole idea is that just targeting these cells by themselves isn't going to work. You have to not only get them to try to eliminate their action, but you also have to do something positive to beef up the right portion of the immune system to attack tumors. So it's what they so-called active immunotherapy. The idea is to get these cells out of the way so that the active immunotherapy can do its job.
Are we very close to seeing that kind of thing happen in the clinic?
Well, there are some, you know, preliminary clinical trials going on, but I mean, I wouldn't want to give anybody the false hope that this is going to be the only answer. There are certain other approaches that people are looking at too. Increasing the cell's differentiation is only one. But the immune system is so complicated that you never know quite for sure how all this is going to come out.
Jean Marks, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science Magazine senior correspondent Jean Marks writes about cancer's bulwark against the immune system. You can read her article in this week's Science. Scientists think that 91 million years ago, the temperature of the oceans was around 35 degrees Celsius, or just below body temperature. Other data from that period suggest that even with all that heat, there was still a large ice sheet on the planet, about half the size of the one that currently covers Antarctica. In a paper in this week's Science, Andre Borneman and colleagues present evidence that confirms both the high temperatures and the large ice sheet. Science News writer Richard Kerr writes about the paper and the super greenhouse temperatures of the Cretaceous period in a News of the Week article. Does this paper mean that climatologists will have to sort of refigure their models of our current weather patterns given our period of global climate change?
No, not right now. It's a reminder that the models are not fully capable of simulating climate at all times on Earth. So going forward, modelers are going to have to keep this in mind, but it's not settled yet.
So what's the context then for this climate model? Something that happened 91 million years ago in the Cretaceous period?
Well, this is doing paleoclimatology, and it's quite paleo at 91 million years ago. But this was a time in the Cretaceous period that is known to have been very warm, and not just warmer than today, but the polar regions were particularly warm.
How did the scientists know that?
Well, there are various what they call proxies that rather than being able to pull a thermometer out from 91 million years ago, there are either particular fossils that tell them about temperature, for example, crocodile fossils in the high Arctic at that time. It could have been microfossils. Some microscopic floating plankton have definite temperature preferences.
And crocodiles normally prefer warm weather, so to find them in the Arctic is pretty unusual.
Yes. Well, we think of them today, southern United States. They certainly weren't up at Ellesmere Island anytime lately. A third temperature proxy can be geochemical. There are isotopic variations which are influenced by temperature of the seawater that things were growing in.
So this had presented a challenge for paleoclimatologists looking at the Cretaceous period. Why exactly?
Well, for some time, they've been challenged by the existence of this tremendous warmth at high latitudes. Their models would not warm the polar regions that way unless they really cheated. This paper brings up an issue that's been around for a few years, but probably as forcefully as it ever has been. And that is, okay, it was warm. Could you possibly have lots of ice in this hothouse world? The modelers generally shake their heads. They can't really understand how that could be. But this latest research does everything right in the way of paleoclimatology. And the answer they get is, well, it looks like there was, oh, maybe an ice sheet half the size of the modern Antarctic ice sheet in the world then.
So they've established the high temperatures during that period of time, but also found evidence for an ice sheet?
That's right.
So what did they look for evidence in establishing both of these two things?
Well, the paleoclimate indicators or proxies have given a clear sign of these high temperatures, even at high latitudes. In this case, they're looking at two indicators. One, a classic technique, looking at so-called forams, these microscopic animals that used to float in the ocean near the surface, and others like to live on the sea floor. They looked at the oxygen isotope compositions of these shells that are left behind and compared them, and that told them that there was a sign of a change in the isotopic composition of the ocean, the whole ocean, 91 million years ago. And it's a kind of change that the only way people can generally think of it happening is to have water going out of the oceans and onto the land as ice. This is a traditional technique, and it's had its problems over the years. So they applied a newer technique, and this is an analysis of very specific organic compounds left in the sediment by microbes that lived at the time. And that's a very good temperature indicator. And by using that as a check, they could be sure that the isotopes weren't misleading them, that it wasn't just some temperature effect, but it really was an ice effect.
And the higher temperatures were confirmed by this second newer technique?
Yes, all this new data is confirming the high temperatures and adding in evidence for all this ice.
Well, what's next then for the researchers? Is there some sort of confirmation step that they need or?
Well, everyone's intrigued. They find this new evidence provocative. Provocative was a favorite word. But they're not convinced, if only because they find it so hard to imagine what the ice would be doing on Antarctica surrounded by all this heat. So it's much the usual call for more data, but more data from different parts of the world. There's concern that maybe there's something peculiar about this one particular spot in the western tropical Atlantic where they're reading this global signal.
Richard Kerr, thank you very much.
Welcome, Rob. My pleasure.
Science news writer Richard Kerr reports on the climate wackiness in the Cretaceous super greenhouse. You can read his article and the original research by Andre Borneman and colleagues in this week's Science.
What was the first thing you really loved to do? Was it pore over books about dinosaurs? Study the player stats on the backs of baseball cards.
Kate Travis edits a Science Careers feature on how scientists are finding themselves changing careers and following dreams.
Doing science takes extreme focus, so it's not unusual for scientists to find themselves well along a career path before stepping back and realizing, wait a minute, I'm not sure this is really what I want to do. But scientists have a variety of transferable skills and can usually change course fairly easily. Though sometimes changing careers means following your dreams into something completely different.
It was a hobby. Sometimes it felt more like a job, but technically it was a hobby. It wasn't paying the bills.
Keith Woolner rediscovered his love of baseball statistics while working as a software developer. He started reading up on how people were developing new statistics to analyze the game. He then started developing his own statistics, which led him to a side job of writing about it. Now,
Woolner works for the Cleveland Indians, using statistics to help the team choose players.
It was not something I went into with the intent of, I'm going to make this kind of career change, and I planned for it years ahead of time. It was really much more a matter that I found something I was passionate about. I stuck with it. I became, you know, well-respected within the field for that expertise, and that opened up opportunities that I never thought would come my way.
For Mike Taylor, his love of dinosaurs led him to pursue a PhD part-time. He continues to work full-time as a computer programmer, but about 7 years ago, his fascination with dinosaurs took off. Eventually, he wanted to do hands-on research, so he signed on to do a PhD in paleontology, even though his previous studies were in math.
I'm finding this enormously more satisfying. You know, I really feel that there are tiny, tiny pockets of my subject that I've really mastered now in a way that I would never have felt about anything I was doing in maths. There's no sort of priesthood. There's no secret societies you have to join or anything like that. You can just start doing science and write papers and send them to journals, and it all just works. It's marvelous, really. Fantastically open process.
Both Taylor and Woolner followed first loves. For cardiologist and author Sandeep Johar, it was a combination of many things that led him to medical school after finishing a PhD in physics.
Physics was an enterprise of reflection. Medicine was an enterprise of prescription and action. And that was really what turned it for me. And, you know, I had been sort of ensconced in the ivory tower of academia doing research on quantum dots. And then I had this very close friend of mine who was struggling with an illness. And although quantum dots were very interesting intellectually, I didn't see the pragmatic dimension that I saw in medicine.
Often, the biggest challenge in following your dreams or pursuing another career is identifying what it is you want to do. Johar says he took all kinds of tests to help him identify what his true interests were.
I remember reading a book once where the author said, write down all the things that you like to do. The thing that you're most embarrassed about is probably what you should be doing for your career. You know, very often we don't trust our impulses, you know, what it is that we really like to do, because there's so much externally imposed codes and etiquette from family and society. But once you figure out what you really want to do, then you'll figure out a path for how to get there. Right?
Mike Taylor really wanted to study dinosaurs, so he did, part-time as a hobby. And even though his research has landed him in newspapers and magazines, he doesn't think he'll ever have a career in paleontology. But that doesn't mean he doesn't think about how things might have gone differently if he had taken a zoology course while in university.
But I can't say I regret it, because the very fact that I'm only doing this for the love of it gives me an enormous freedom, really. I can say and do things that other people can't, because they always need to have an eye on their job prospects. I'm very much free to study what I'm interested in at the time, and I don't have to worry about which areas are being funded well or anything like that. So actually, I think if you're in a job that leaves you enough spare time, then doing this kind of thing in your spare time is a fantastic way to do it.
But whether a hobby or a career, baseball statistician Keith Woolner says that when you find something that really captivates you, you'll find the time for it because it's important to you.
What really clicked is when I found something that is what I wanted to spend my time on, and that's when things really kind of clicked and started developing.
It's hard to give solid advice on how to follow your dreams to a different career. Sandeep Johar says there's no substitute for some good old-fashioned soul searching.
Because there's so many choices, you have to really know what you want to do. And a lot of that just comes down to really searching within your own heart.
Johar, Taylor, and Woolner all found themselves coming back to subjects that had captivated their interest much earlier in their lives. If you're considering a career change, don't overlook subjects or hobbies you've abandoned. Think about why you left those subjects behind and whether you're still passionate about them. As our stories this week show, it's never too late for a second chance at a first love. For Science Careers, this is Kate Travis.
You can read these stories in this week's edition of Science Careers. Find them online at sciencecareers.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, today I've got a bit of a science cookbook for you. We're going to talk about how to use a river to make a mountain, how to use star clusters to make a galaxy, And finally, how to make a butterfly that uses the sun like a compass.
That's an interesting cookbook. I didn't think rivers could make mountains, but would take them down. How's that work?
Well, it's a really interesting process, and this has to do with a river known as the Yarling Tsangpo River that flows through the Himalayan mountains of Tibet. And this is actually the highest and steepest river in the world. Its total drop is about 3,000 meters, which is more than twice that of the Mississippi in less than half the length. So this is a very powerful river we're talking about.
Well, all that power probably means a lot of erosion, doesn't it? So how does the river help make a mountain? Is it through deposits or something like that?
No, what's actually happening is that the river is so powerful, it's actually eroding a tectonic plate, one of the Earth's crustal plates. And it's causing what the researchers are calling a tectonic aneurysm. And basically what that means is that it's deforming this plate, which is the Indian crustal plate, so much that it's lightened part of the plate enough that a small part of the plate is actually bending upward more rapidly than the rest, which is thrusting up some of the surrounding landscape, causing a nearby mountain to grow much faster than other mountains in the region. So as opposed to what we think of rivers eroding landscape, this is an example of a river that can actually cause the landscape to rise, or at least part of the landscape, faster than it normally would.
Well, turning to the next page in your cookbook of stories this week, how to make a Milky Way.
Right, and this story concerns our Milky Way galaxies and others like it, which are known as spiral galaxies. And astronomers have been trying to figure out how did these galaxies form in the first place. And luckily, because of the way our universe is, the farther astronomers look away in the universe, the further back in time they also look. And so astronomers use the Hubble Space Telescope and a few other telescopes to look about 12 billion years back in our universe's history. And they were searching for the star clusters that made up galaxies like our Milky Way.
So by looking back, they can see several instances of earlier versions of the Milky Way type of galaxy?
Well, not so much earlier versions, but clusters of stars that eventually over time would have merged with other clusters and built up to form galaxies like the Milky Way. And they've had several candidates, but they really couldn't figure out which ones were the ones that made galaxies like our Milky Way. But thanks to some very persistent observation, they came across some collections of stars known as Lyman alpha emitters, which are about 10 times smaller and 20 to 40 times less massive than the Milky Way. And by the way these clusters emit starlight, and by the way they're positioned in space, this team of astronomers was able to deduce that these, in fact, were the building blocks of our Milky Way. And they liken the discovery to finding key fossils in the evolution of Homo sapiens, or even discovering embryonic stem cells. They really found some of the preliminary building blocks that made galaxies like our Milky Way.
Well, from finding that missing link to understanding how butterflies find their way.
Right. Well, this story, Rob, is all about monarch butterflies, which have a very impressive migration. They fly from various parts of eastern North America to a very specific part of Mexico, a journey of up to 3,000 kilometers. And scientists know that somehow they use the sun as a guide to do this, but they're not really sure how they do it. And part of the problem is that the sun is obviously not always in the same position in the sky. So how do the butterflies use the sun to navigate when the sun is always changing positions?
Well, is there something in them that takes note of the sun, say, at daybreak or something like that?
Well, that's what the researchers have found. They suspected that the butterflies must have some sort of internal timekeeping mechanism, and they would use this timekeeping mechanism to somehow coordinate the sun's position in the sky, and that would help them navigate. But they really weren't sure what was really going on a molecular level. And so a team of researchers assembled basically a DNA database from these monarchs and were able to find two families of genes known as cryptochromes. And these genes were first isolated in plants and were recently also found in flies and mice. And what they're responsible for is helping synchronize these creatures' circadian rhythm, which is basically the body's internal clock. And the researchers found that butterflies had a cryptochrome that resembled the fly cryptochrome and also a cryptochrome that resembled the mouse cryptochrome. So this was unusual because they thought before this that species only tended to have one type of cryptochrome. And what the researchers found with further study was that one of these cryptochromes oscillated daily in the part of the monarch brain responsible for following the sun, like a compass. And basically now what you have are the two pieces of the puzzle. You have the internal compass, but you also have this clock which helps them synchronize the compass with the sun so that they are not getting confused when the sun changes position in the sky. So scientists now know a whole lot more about how these monarchs make this pretty incredible journey.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what's in next week's cookbook of stories?
Well, we're looking into a few stories for next week. We're looking into a story about how hypnosis is revealing how the brain suppresses certain memories, how tiny RNAs determine whether a cancer metastasizes or not, and finally, how protons help worms poop.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the January 11th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.